This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, and welcome to Tech Trader on Barron's Live. I'm Barron's Associate Editor Eric Savitz, and I am happy to welcome to the program today, Kelly Rodriguez, who's the CEO of Forge Global. Kelly, it's great to see you again, and thanks for being with us.
Great to be here, Eric. Thanks for having me.
So I want to do a little level setting to make sure people understand what you guys do. So give us a sort of brief overview of Forge's business, and then we'll kind of get into more nitty-gritty.
Great. Well, broadly, we think of ourselves as an infrastructure provider for the private markets. But within that, there's a core marketplace where investors in over 70 countries can buy and sell secondary private shares in many of the world's most sought after unicorns. But in addition to that core trading business, there's a data business where you can subscribe to and get information about what's traded before, at what price, indications of interest across 700 companies. There's also a custodial capability where you could hold your assets with us. And then we provide a service to companies that want to run organized liquidity programs, but they want to do it at market-based pricing in sort of an auction format. So that combination of trading, data, and custody is what makes up Forge.
Got it. So in effect, you are providing, it's a market for shares of companies that have not yet IPO'd. These are largely venture-backed companies, although I presume that there could be other structures there, but there are individuals and institutions that own shares in these companies. And then you have people who want to sell them and people who want to buy them. And
that's right.
In the middle. How people have been trying to do this for a while, and it's taken a little time for the market to develop. Give us a little sense of the history here and where we are in the evolution of this market for equity that's traditionally not nearly as liquid as, say, a public market stock.
Yeah, it's been at least a 10-year road to get here, and we're still kind of early in the market. If you think about it, there's about 1,300 unicorns now in the world, valued at something like $4.6 trillion. But if you go back a couple of decades, companies were going public at about a $500 million valuation. There weren't unicorns in the world, and hence the name. But in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a shift that's happened, and that is companies are recognizing now that if they're going to stay private for 12, 13, 18 years, which is what Palantir was when they went out last year, you eventually have to acknowledge that your shareholders and your employees, if they're on that journey, they need to have access to be able to sell their stock. A fund life is 5 to 10 years. An employee's stock options vest in 4 typically. And if you work at a place for 8 years, you've got to have a way to deal with this. So companies now are starting to realize that to retain talent and to have access to an evolving pool of capital, this is not just venture capitalists now. The investors that are coming into these deals globally are family offices, hedge funds, investors that used to only invest in IPOs are now coming into these companies pre-IPO. So it does create a range of requirement to provide liquidity, and that liquidity at scale requires technology and infrastructure. So it's evolving, but we're still pretty early. Last year, we did about $3.2 billion of transaction volume. And if you think about that against $4.6 trillion, and we're one of the market leaders in the space, so it's still pretty early.
So one thing I'm curious about is there was a time when venture-backed companies were not always so cooperative about allowing transactions in their shares. It affects their cap table. They get nervous about wanting to control who owns shares in their companies. And I wonder if that's loosened. So, like, is it largely the case that companies are comfortable with this? And in fact, in some cases, as you say, they have a real incentive to do this because they want to provide some liquidity to their long-term employees who may not yet be where the company might not yet really be ready to exit.
Yeah, I think a company, rightfully so, wants to know who's on their cap table, and they want to feel comfortable with who's on their cap table.
Right.
And while that persists, I think there is a comfort that happens when you're ready to do it. And until then, you may not be comfortable. And so part of what we do here is, because we have this data product, whenever there's indications of interest, we notify a company. If employees show up and want to sell their stock, we notify a company. And so it's really important that if you're a CEO or a board of directors, if you've got pent up liquidity demands in your stock, you want to know about it, because you'd rather know that than have your employee quit and go some other place like Automation Anywhere or SpaceX, where they offer formalized liquidity programs. Right. And they've got friends that work in these other places. And I feel the same way about Forge. We went public, you know, last quarter, but I wanted to know when employees wanted liquidity, because I wanted to take care of them and not have it surprise me.
So let's just detour for a second, since you mentioned the IPO. You guys did a SPAC deal, I think, in just very recently, right? It was
in March.
In March. So it's brand new. I think you've had one earnings quarter reported so far. The stock has been, I would be remiss not to point out that the stock has been wildly volatile. You're well above the SPAC price. So I think when I looked this morning, the stock was around $19. Typical SPAC price is 10. But you've been as like high into the 30s. The stock just has huge volatility. And I wonder if you had any thoughts on what that was about. I mean, and whether you've become sort of a proxy in some ways for the private equity or the venture capital market. I'm curious how you think about that.
Well, we deliberately set out to be the first private marketplace to be public. We thought that was important for the very reason you bring up, which is the world and regulators still don't allow unaccredited investors to buy and sell private stock. And we understand the protections that they're seeking. But we also felt like Forge, as an infrastructure provider to the private market, could be viewed as a proxy for participating in the private markets. And when you've seen, you know, periods of up and to the right, as we've seen in the last several years, you know, we've done well with that. And so we did want to offer our stock to investors that otherwise couldn't buy a single issue or name in the private market. Right. On the subject of volatility, everything's volatile right now because of the trifecta of the war and interest rates and inflation. And we're no different. I mean, we're part of the public market. We don't control that. We've been, you know, we've been enthusiastic about our long-term prospects. Mm-hmm. We've tried not to look at the stock every day, and they tell you not to do that, but we do anyway, because it's been kind of a wild ride.
Yeah.
So we're continuing to stay focused on building a great and very large global business. And that's our goal. But there's a lot of movement in everything right now. And I was just at Draper's conference a week ago, and I talked about us being the last SPAC standing, because we got out in Q1 and it looked in Q4 like the SPAC market was going to get really, really hard. And so we're super grateful that we were able to do that with the support of our investors.
Got it. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what you're seeing in the market. I would note that you guys do a monthly update that's on your website. That's very helpful to get some color on the state of the private, the secondary market in private shares. And of course, the public market and private public market has been hugely volatile, has been particularly in technology shares, which tend to dominate the list of unicorns. The you know, public market tech stocks have gotten killed over the last 6 months or so, as we all know. It's basically a bear market in technology shares. You have lots of things that are down 30, 40, 50, 60%. And as you guys have pointed out in your research materials, recent IPOs have, yours notwithstanding, have generally been very badly treated in the public market. And people who bought on the IPO price have generally gotten pretty badly hurt here. So how is that translated into your market? What are you seeing in terms of behavior of buyers and sellers and the level of activity? Give us a snapshot of what's going on.
Yeah, sure. Well, we started publishing this private market update to wrap the data that's available through Forge Data, or Forge Intelligence is the name of our product. But we wanted to put some insights around it and start to publish that. And the most recent one that we put out really covers the first quarter and a little bit of in April. Mm-hmm. And a couple of things of note, the sentiments that started in December of last year as the markets came down, we started to see increased activity from sellers. This has been a market that in the last 5 years, with as hot as the stock market has been, supply and sellers have been harder to find than demand, than investors.
Right.
Well, that flipped. And so now what you have is a period of time where there are more sellers and a lot more. And I think the dynamic that exists today, we describe as price discovery equilibrium or disequilibrium. There's a disjointedness right now. And here's how I would explain it. You have sellers that have come in that want to sell right now. The market's volatile and investors around the world expect a discount. But a lot of sellers in the market, now this number has changed over time, didn't want to give a discount because they're operating under the psychology of 2021, even though it's a different time now in, you know, Q1 and Q2 right. of 2022.
So one thing to make, I think I want to make clear here, Kelly, is like when you say a discount, are we talking about a, now that's like if you were in the public market and you were saying that, right, it would be like a discount to yesterday's close, say, right? But like, they don't have, there is no like yesterday's close necessarily, right? Because the trading is not, isn't so liquid as that. So I presume we're talking about relative to the last round. Is that how you think about the discount?
Well, relative to the last round or relative to what is being offered. Hmm. And I guess what I mean by that is if the private markets have historically, our marketplace in recent years has sold shares that have been at a premium of the last round. And if you think about rounds happening once a year, if you're buying 6 months after the last round, then you would expect to pay a premium. As an example, in Q4 of 2021, the average trade that happened on Forge was at a 58% premium to the last round. Now that last round could be a month ago, could be 10 months ago. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the end of Q1, where we sit now in Q2, the premium is at a 24% premium of the last round. And so the discount is all from the expectation of that premium, and in mm-hmm. some cases, over the price that's being offered. Because if you're an employee or a holder of those shares, you expect to get paid what someone else got paid or what has been sure. You know, traded in the last couple of days. And so that's moved. And I think what we see is buyer and seller sentiment have to overlap for there to be a trade to happen. Now, it's important to point out that if 24% is the discount that is being, I'm sorry, 24% is the premium that's being paid right now, a trade won't happen if somebody else wants to buy that same stock at a 10% premium.
Right.
So right now we're watching this concept of price discovery equilibrium very carefully. And that's one of the reasons why you've seen volume in the private market slow in Q1.
That's interesting. So, because you have on the one hand, So if I'm a longtime employee, I wonder, well, this is an interesting question. I wonder, does it depend on where I came in? So like if I was an early employee, if I have I have stock going back to the seed stage, and I, you know, maybe my shares are priced in pennies, I may not be that particular about exactly the number that I get, because I know that I'm going to make a lot more money. On the other hand, if you were a late stage investor in the current environment, where we have seen some companies, so Instacart notably, for example, recently lowered their valuation estimate, and I presume there's actually a lot of that going on that doesn't actually rise above the surface where we can see it. Your attitude might be different. You might be a little more reluctant to want to take a discount on shares where you're actually maybe not making any money or losing money, as opposed to the early investors who might be.
It's interesting. We have a whole section of our site now, which is dedicated to early is everything. Hmm. And what we do is we show companies that have recently gone public, and we show how they're trading relative to their IPO versus how they're trading relative to their last private round. And the data is pretty interesting. Of all the companies that we're tracking in the 2021 IPO class, only one is up from their 2021 IPO, and that's Aura Biosciences. Now, they're up 18%, let's say. But if you go back to their last private round, they're up 2,000%. Same with Affirm. If you look at Affirm, and I love Affirm, I know Max Levkin, and they're down 56% from their IPO, but they're up 70% from their last private round. And so that really strikes at the sentiment you're talking about, Eric. If you're someone who worked there and when they raised their Series B, then, you know, a 9% discount, and I'm going to give you this number now because people are asking me. If you look at the first quarter of 2022, the trades that happened on Forge and the same companies that traded in Q4 are trading at around 9% lower. So 9% is kind of a lot if you're trading public stock, but in private stock, if you were in the Series B, 9% discounts probably feels pretty good to you.
Right. I mean, to make up some numbers, if you were, you know, your stock was priced, let's call it a dollar. We'll just make up a number. And now you have to take, I don't know, $45 instead of $50. Okay.
Yeah,
I can do that because you aren't getting liquidity for stock that you weren't realizing, and now you can go buy your Tesla or the new house.
Well, yeah, people still need to buy a house and send their kids to college, so yeah, they're going to make the trade.
Do you think that over time that a bid ask spread, if you want to call it that, which has slowed the completion rate, right? Because there's just like you have, because what you do, it would seems to me, you can tell me if this characterization is fair, but on the one hand, you have people who like have a higher level of urgency to get liquid. And that could be either because A, maybe other parts of their portfolio are suffering, or B, they're worried about what's going to happen, and they're just worried about the economy. There's lots of reasons why that could be true. And on the other hand, you have buyers who might smell opportunity, right? I can buy, you know, XYZ biosciences at a discount cheaper than I would have been able to get it last quarter or the quarter before that. And to your point, they are quite aware, I think, of the math you laid out, which is that the returns are much higher on late stage investing, or maybe in particular late stage investing, than for the IPO investor. And so the question is, can we get closer to a sort of an equilibrium point, which would then allow, you know, in effect, the volumes to go up and make for a more efficient market?
Well, that's really the core of what we set out to do. And the reason we launched the data product last year, and we're already seeing this in the numbers, if you are going to buy and you're interested in private stock, you want to see this data. You want to understand what you should be paying and what you should be selling for. And the more information you have about that, the more comfortable you are that you're in the zone. And that creates more volume and more confidence. And we've already seen this. The people that have subscribed to Forge Intelligence, the institutions particularly, because that's who it's targeting initially, they're translating into more trades because they've got more information about what's come before them and IOIs from either buyers and sellers, indications of interest about what they'd be willing to sell or buy at. So once you have access to that, then your confidence level goes up. And I think that's part of what we see as a core piece of the infrastructure for the private markets. And look, if you look at the public markets, the New York Stock Exchange, their holding company, ICE, and NASDAQ, and exchanges all around the world make more of their money today off from data than they do trade settlement fees.
Right.
And there's that's basically what's coming to the private market.
Do you I wonder how you think about the risk level to individual investors who are interested in this, because they see, you know, they say they read your data and they see I'm going to get outsized returns if I invest early rather than wait for an IPO. And so they're trying to be smart. They want to own some private stocks. And yet, you know, the protections are not the same, right? Like they don't file 10-Qs, right? Like there's not as much data about some of these companies. And so I wonder whether there's any sort of intermediate vehicle. So maybe I want to own a basket of private shares. And, you know, so I wondered if there are existing structured products like that that have emerged and whether that might be a good way for an individual investor to think about getting exposure.
Yeah, we definitely believe in that. And in fact, we're holding our own webinar featuring a couple of fund managers who are doing just this. And if you think about it, picking an individual stock, I think the return data that we have obviously makes it attractive in the private market. But if you want to diversify and you want to hold a basket of these as kind of a long-term strategy, then that's coming. And that kind of product requires data because a fund manager, unless you're a VC, you want to have some systematic way of picking what's in that basket. Right. You don't want to just say, hey, I'm going to analyze 100 private unicorns and figure out which 30 I'm going to put in this value. You want to have data. So that's coming to market. Today, that's mostly still for accredited investors. But as these products get listed as either interval funds or indexes on the public exchanges, then you'll see the market really open up. But in a funny way, your original point was true. You know, because Forge serves, you know, over 500 companies have traded on Forge. If you think about the way that we make money off from data and transaction fees, we kind of look like that basket in some ways.
Right.
But there are products coming to market that will really right. explicitly allow you to invest in 30, 50, 100 names. And Equiem is one of them. That's one of the ones that's on our panel. And others are coming that will be publicly traded. So we're excited about that.
Do you think that the valuations that you're seeing in the secondary market, do they tend to lag the public market activity? Because there's always a little bit of a you know, we see the public market, of course, state the obvious is mark to market, like when the market's open, like every second, right? Like we know where the market is right this second. But we don't know that necessarily about the private market. And so to your point on the sort of gap between buyers and sellers and the indications of interest, like, is there a tend to be a lag, like in the way that valuations flow from public to private? Like, I would note, right? Like when you're talking about like last year, you know, or you know, certainly during the rally in stock prices, you saw value. To your point, right? You saw valuations in the private market well above the last round because people are anticipating. We got a great IPO market. We're going to get this thing public. I'm going to make a lot of money, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you just look at last year over this year, you can see it in the numbers. We grew about 75% organically year over year in 2021 over 2020, and the markets were up and to the right. It was one of the biggest IPO years in history.
Right.
If you take a look at how the market has declined since Q4, and you compare that to the pricing data I just cited, where we're down roughly 9% from Q1 to Q4, the public markets are probably down in the 20s.
Right.
And in Q4, when the market started to slip, we didn't see any price differential. So there is a lag, there is a latency. And part of that has to do with the private markets not being as liquid. So even if you wanted to sell it in Q4 and you had a buyer in Q4, that trade might not happen until Q1.
Right.
And so, yes, there is some latency. And that's why price discovery is so important and ultimately an efficient way to make a trade. So structurally in the private markets, there are these SPVs that sit on cap tables. We've got over 100 of them on cap tables today.
SPV is
That's a special purpose vehicle. It's like a fund that sits on a cap table.
Right.
And if you're buying and selling in one of those, that trade can happen relatively quickly, like in a couple of days. But if you're going through and doing a direct purchase from a shareholder that's already on a cap table, well, companies have certain policies in place and rules about how you transfer, and it's got to get approved and go through a process. And that can take 2 weeks, it could take 4 weeks, it could take 6 weeks. So right. That efficiency, along with the data discovery, is what we're working on so that trades can happen faster. And the faster they happen, with more price discovery, the less latency to the general broad markets that you're going to find. And we're seeing that now. If you compare it back to when the pandemic hit, you're starting to see more efficient price discovery. That's part of, again, why we wanted to build an infrastructure play for the private markets.
Kelly, do you guys publish any of the data on like which companies are seeing the most activity? Right. So because one question, right, you know, obviously, to your point, right, there's what, 1300 unicorns.
Mm-hmm.
There's not active trading in 1300 unicorns. Right. So for a whole host of reasons, some of them might not allow it. Some of them, I mean, there may be a lot of reasons why you might not see activity. But so if I was going to get into this market, the first thing I want to know is, well, what's available? Like, where,
yeah.
You know, can I buy? I'm sure that, like, you know, so if you think about, so the largest ones, right, you think about, I don't know, Stripe, or you think about SpaceX, or you think about, like, kind of names that people may inherently know, they might be the first place that they look. But, like, do you publish, like a most actives list?
Yeah, we publish something called Opportunities. And that really is meant to do a couple of things. It basically says, here's what's new that's come to market.
Mm-hmm.
And it can also say, here's what's active that's in market. And if you were a subscriber to our data product, you will actually see what's trading. You'll see what's active.
Right.
And in most cases, the most actively traded name is going to be a name that has got a pending IPO. Like, everyone knows they're going public. They've announced they're going public. Mm-hmm. We kind of know when they're going public. And that draws a lot of attention, as do the really large cap decacorns. Now, interestingly, some of those don't trade because the second something becomes available, there's immediate demand for it. And so it's hard to get. But, you know, it's a range. But to answer your question, last year we had about 200 names, unique names trade. Now, we've traded historically 500, but in any given period of time, there's a different set of active names. So, for example, last year in Q3, when Palantir went, that was the most actively traded name on the platform. And I think we did close to $400 million of trade volume in that name. So, but then that's public and the next quarter it's gone. So it depends on sort of what's going on in the market. But if it's a long-standing company that's been around for a long time that's delivering some form of disclosure or published data, then that starts to inform what can trade more actively.
That's interesting that you get a surge in volume pre-IPO, because the one could argue, well, I could see it two different ways, right? On the one hand, you might say, well, there's still a little bit of risk around, you know, completion of the deal, and I'd rather take my money now, and maybe I'll take a discount of whatever I think the IPO price is going to be. And I suppose on a buyer side, you might say, no, I want to buy this. I want, if I can get it below the IPO price, I want to buy it ahead of time. And you do see, like, I mean, historically, right, like we've seen with like late stage, like kind of late stage rounds where you've got like even mutual fund companies, like the, you know,
yes,
these and T Rose and people like that tend to like late stage deals because they get better returns and they can get larger allocations and stuff like that. Are you seeing those kinds of players participate in the market, like large institutions? Can they get enough volume?
Oh, yes. In fact, if you take a look at the direct listing phenomenon that has started now, we're, the IPO window is all but closed at this point. Right. But if you look last year at the companies that went out on direct listings, we saw particular volumes from what have historically been IPO allocation or syndicate investors come into the private markets. We saw this with Slack. We saw this with Palantir. We saw this with Spotify back in 2018. Because the companies come into market, they're not raising capital for the most part in a direct listing, and a large institution wants to have a piece of that company. And so they'll come in and buy it in the private space before the company actually lists. You see that more in directs because historically those direct listings did not actually raise capital on an IPO, right, on a conventional IPO. Right. But even in a conventional IPO, we could see institutions, large institutions and hedge funds start to come onto the platform and look at what was available in those names that were going out. And I think that's a trend that's here to stay.
Okay. We're running short on time. I want to just ask a couple of last questions. One is, I'm curious if there's any participation on the private equity side. Like those deals tend to be a little bit structured differently. So you have, you know, large institutions, a different type of institution. Have they participated in this market at all, either as buyers or sellers?
Yeah, so the whole capital markets sort of segment investing has shifted somewhat. So PE right. firms who have historically been PE and control buyers have moved into the private markets more. And if you take a look at, you know, Motive, who was our backer, you know, they're sort of this combination of a private equity and venture capital player. And you're seeing mm-hmm. those lines blur. But in terms of private equity-backed companies being on the platform, that would only be the case if there was a broad set of holders that were looking for liquidity. If a PE firm like a KKR or a Carlyle buys a controlling interest in a company, the chances of them putting it or allowing it to trade on a forge, if it's closely held, are lower. But those same companies are starting to buy things in the private sphere, and certainly in the late stage sphere, and we're seeing them participate. So yes, but it really comes down to what the holding structure is of those companies. It requires that there are shareholders that want to sell.
Okay, so one other thing I want to touch on briefly is. There are some other players in this market, and I wonder whether, in order to fully realize the potential of the market, they need to be either interconnected or consolidated. I mean, imagine if, like, so you know, if you think about the public markets, yes, you know, there's some third market you can trade. You know, there's some other places institutions can trade shares, but for the most part, it's a single market. If I want to buy or sell Microsoft shares, I don't have to shop around necessarily to figure out the best place to do that. I wonder how you think this market evolves over time, whether it's likely to be consolidation or simply maybe a shared.
Yeah,
shared network.
It will definitely consolidate, and that's just the nature of any maturing market. and even in the US, you've got NASDAQ and you've got the New York Stock Exchange and you've got markets all over the world. There probably isn't going to be one of these in the world at scale. There's probably going to be two or three. But right now, there are dozens of small players around the world and probably two or three of them that are smaller than Forge here in the US. And I suspect that as capital and Forge raised over $200 million when we went public, the highly capitalized players will drive some of that consolidation.
And so, you've already done, you did one acquisition.
Yes,
already.
Yes. We acquired Shares Post back in 2019. We closed the deal in 2020. You'll see more of that. It's just a natural phenomenon. And part of the reason we went public was to be able to use our public stock to acquire other companies.
Okay. Last question. I'm curious if you had any thoughts about the outlook for valuations and for the market as we, you know, we are in this very volatile, I think as you mentioned earlier, you know, you've got like all kinds of issues, war, macroeconomic uncertainty, fear of recession, rising interest rates, all the stuff we know we've all been talking about in recent months. Given all that, how are you feeling about the outlook for, you know, for your own business and also for the secondary market?
Yeah, long term, I couldn't be more excited about it. Because if I look at some of the data out there around how many unicorns there are in the world, how much of it trades, what the returns look like, I've never been more excited about the prospects of the private market and Forge in it than I am right now. Even with the dislocation that's going on now, I mean, cycles come and go, and there are is a convergence of macroeconomic events taking place right now that's particularly right. acute. So long-term, amazing, short-term, tough.
Right.
That's how I'm thinking about it.
Got it. Kelly, thank you so much for this. This was really fun. And we'll have to check in again later in the year and see how things are going as the world turns on. We'll see. There's lots going on.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone for joining us today. Please join us again tomorrow. We'll have a session on the housing crisis. Quentin Fottrell, the managing editor of Personal Finance at MarketWatch, will talk to Emma Ackerman, another MarketWatch reporter, and Adam Perdue, who's an economist at Texas A&M, about the real estate market. Thanks again to everyone, and please stay safe.